Good morning. I want to take just a moment before we begin our study of God's Word this morning to extend once again a warm welcome to all of you who may be visiting with us this morning. We do have some here who are not regular members or attendees of this assembly, and so we appreciate very much your presence here this morning, the fact that you've chosen to come and to join with us in worship of God and now in the study of His Word. And I would encourage you, as we talk about the death of Jesus Christ this morning, meditate upon the sacrifice that has been made for you and for me, and to decide what it means for your life in particular. As Gary indicated, Mel Gibson's film, The Passion of the Christ, having opened this past Wednesday, has already been the subject of much discussion and controversy for probably over a year now. People were criticizing his film prior to even the end of its filming, and certainly before it was finished. Unless you've been living in a cave recently, and that would be a cave without television, any kind of computers or print media or cell phones or radios, you're aware that Gibson's movie purports to be an account of the final 12 hours of Jesus' life. It was interesting to me that as big a blockbuster star as Mel Gibson has been over the years, film distributors in Hollywood were not very anxious to pick up the opportunity to distribute this film, which he financed from his own resources. And yet, it has opened this last week on Ash Wednesday, as that holiday is celebrated by Roman Catholics. It opened in packed theaters across the country. His film has already been wildly successful in terms of opening day receipts, and it is suggested by some it may be one of the biggest money-making films in the history of the cinema. Gibson's film has been described in a number of ways. Some rave about it as being an experience, a religious experience. Others, including John Meacham, who wrote a feature article in Newsweek on February 16th this year, describes it as powerful but troubling. Mel Gibson has been interviewed by probably anybody who can find a mic recently. In fact, if you're like I am, you are suffering a little bit from overload, information overload. There's just too much to digest about Mel Gibson's film and, of course, all that goes along with that. But Gibson has become a lightning rod for virulent criticism due to the nature of his film. I read just this last week that some in Hollywood are critical of his film because it's too violent. Hollywood, you know, is much more into gentle films. Hypocrisy knows no bounds, it appears, when it can be directed, or criticism can be directed, against religion and particularly against Christianity. Last Sunday morning, we talked a little bit about this article that appeared in Newsweek, and I'm going to ask your indulgence, your patience. I understand you may not be nearly as interested in Newsweek as many people are. I think the article is important because it, in a sense, serves as representative criticism against this film. And that criticism says something about the religious world, about our society in general. It is for that reason that last week I addressed Mr. Meacham's assertions about the inspired nature of the Gospels. According to him, the Gospel writers were partisans who wrote in order to follow or to accomplish certain social and political agendas. He questions the historicity of these accounts, that is, whether they really are accurate in their portrayal of the details of the event of Jesus' passion. In fact, the criticism of anti-Semitism has been leveled against Gibson because in the film he presents the Jews, the Jewish nation, as instigators in the death of Jesus. I am well aware, perhaps you are also, that anti-Semitism has been a problem in the history of the Roman Catholic Church, and in fact, even now continues to be a powerful prejudice in Western European countries. Some have estimated that anti-Semitism is probably as strong in Europe now as it was in the 1930s prior to the Second World War. You may recall some of the consequences of that particular prejudice at that time. It is my opinion, however, that the charge of anti-Semitism is being used by Hollywood, and for that matter, by a lot of religious individuals, Hollywood typically is not, as a social cudgel to discourage people like Gibson and others who might be so bold as he has been, to discourage them from telling the truth about the passion of Jesus Christ. There are those who, for political reasons, do not want the Jews, even of the first century, to be portrayed in an unfavorable light. There are a lot of religious people who would be classified as premillennialists, meaning that they believe that at some point in the future, God's chosen people, the modern nation of Israel now, will figure prominently in God's redemptive plan, and that in fact, the United States has a vested political interest and survival interest in supporting that nation for that very reason. And of course, I believe the liberal media has, of course, been very quick to criticize Gibson with this charge of anti-Semitism because they have no love for any religion that is associated with Jesus Christ or the Bible. If he'd chosen to write about the death of Muhammad, it would have been an epic film. But because it talks about Christianity and even purports to follow the Bible, it is anathema as far as they are concerned. You need to understand they're biased from the outset if you didn't understand that already, and I feel fairly confident that you do. This morning I want to accomplish three things, and I will warn you this is not a short sermon. Nor do I intend to run through all of this as fast as I'd probably like to. I am going to run through some of these things, these quotations. I have a number of them from his article and a telephone radio interview that he did just within this last month. I am going to summarize a few of those quotations. However, I have placed at the back of the auditorium in the vestibule on the credenza there, a sheet where if you'd like, you can sign your name. I will provide you with a copy of my outline. Everything that I've been using to preach this morning, including all of the quotations in their full extent, you can get a copy of that if you want it, if you want to look at those things more. Many of you probably will be very glad just to leave after we're done. But what I'm going to do this morning is three things. I want to use Meacham's article in Newsweek, because I believe, as I've stated, that it is representative of much of the criticism that Gibson is receiving because of his film, and also the Bible over the centuries, the criticism that it has received. I want to show you from the Scriptures, although it is certainly not any mystery, pardon the pun here with Meacham's use of the word, it's not any mystery to us who it is that was responsible for killing Jesus. Nevertheless, we'll look at what the Scriptures say about that. And then last of all, and really the point of my sermon in part, is to warn against the efforts to sanitize the Gospels. The story of Jesus' passion is bloody. It is ugly. It is sinful. That it is associated with the sin of men. And what has been done in the denominational world, and now apparently by the Catholic Church in their efforts to try to demonize Gibson and others, is to sanitize that story. Let's clean it up and make it so that it is as bland as possible. And I'll tell you what the object of that, at least in the minds of the liberal media, is. Let's make it so that it doesn't move anybody. The thing that bothers them about this film, I am convinced, is that it is intensely moving. And it causes people to think about the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. And of course, Satan doesn't want that, nor do his servants. And so we'll try to do those things this morning as we look at some quotations, some comments that are made by John Meacham, who is the managing editor of Newsweek. I want to begin by talking a little bit about some of the criticisms that have been leveled against Gibson's work. And please understand that it's a little difficult to categorize all of the criticisms in broad brush terms. I'm going to do that, but understand that occasionally the criticism, the quotation may not fit exactly, that there's a little different sense. I tried not to keep the organization of, or make the organization of the sermon so difficult to follow that we get lost. And so I'm going to begin by suggesting that Meacham in his article essentially asserts that the gospel accounts, if you read them literally, if you accept them as historically correct documents, are responsible for anti-Semitism. Now, the way that he does that is in a couple of steps. He, first of all, as the first quotation suggests, says that Gibson, and much of his movie, is a literal-minded rendering of the most dramatic passages scattered through the four Gospels. First point he will make in his article is that Gibson purports to stay with the facts of the Gospel. Set out, he says, to stick to the Gospel and has made virtually no nod to critical analysis or content. In other words, Meacham says that Gibson's film is pretty accurate according to the Gospels. And I'll tell you, I've seen the film. I believe that's probably a true statement. I would put some caveats to that. There are some areas in which he gives a nod to Catholic tradition. There are some things that he has been very speculative about. He has taken some artistic liberty at points. Simon of Cyrene does some things and says some things that you have no indication in the text necessarily happened. But I'll tell you, in the main, Gibson's movie is probably as accurate as any biblical historical film has been that I've seen. And so Meacham admits that was Gibson's intent, just to stick with the text. And Meacham says, listen, Gibson hasn't checked out to see what all the Bible scholars say about the reliability of certain aspects of the Gospels. He just took it all like it was truth. Well, shame on him. And that's a criticism. He goes on to say, and the roots of Christian anti-Semitism lie in overly literal readings, which are in fact misreadings of many New Testament texts. If you read the Gospels, and in Matthew 27, the text says that the Jews cried out, His blood be upon us and our children. You have to understand, they didn't really say that. Matthew put that in there, as Meacham will point out later on in his article. And if you just read the Gospels as though they're literally true, you're not going to get the right story. That's what he's saying. In fact, if you read them literally, you will end up being encouraged to be anti-Semitic. That was his point. For Christians, he writes, the passion, from the Latin passus, the word meaning having suffered or having undergone, is the very heart of their faith. Down through the ages, however, when read, that is, the Gospels, read without critical perspective and a proper sense of history. That's code. That's code for saying, if you don't read the Gospels and discount those things that really aren't true, the Christian narratives have sometimes been contorted to lay the responsibility for Jesus' execution at the feet of the Jewish people. Have you come to that conclusion that the Jewish people were responsible for the death of Jesus Christ being crucified? If you have, you've distorted the Gospels according to this individual. You haven't used critical perspective and you've lost a proper sense of history. And that contortion has long fueled the fires of anti-Semitism, he says. And then the last quote on this particular point. He says, and passion plays in general, when produced in contravention to the teachings of the Roman Catholic Church and of many other denominations, have sometimes fueled the fires of anti-Semitism by appearing to place a disproportionate amount of blame for the death of Jesus on those whom the Gospel of John, for instance, calls the Jews. When you produce a passion play, and you don't do it according to the teachings of the Roman Catholic Church or some other man-made religious denomination, if you instead simply follow the details, the historical details that are given in the gospel accounts, you're going to mess up. And you're going to give the impression that the Jews were literally responsible for the death of Jesus Christ. That in turn fuels anti-Semitism. Brethren, we are in a war. We've been in a war for a long time. Gibson's film is just serving to remind us that there's a whole bunch of people out there, in fact, the vast majority of the religious world, who do not believe in the inspiration of the Scriptures, and they need to be defended. These things are untrue. They're charges that are being made, but they are untrue. Nevertheless, a lot of people are going to believe that, already believe that. Now, Meacham, although suggesting that Gibson has stuck to the literal details of the gospel accounts, on the other hand, suggests that in some areas, Gibson has not followed what really happened. Now, he does this in two ways. First of all, he suggests in some cases that what the Gospels say is different than what Gibson understands them to say. And then other times, he just basically throws what the Gospels say out and says, well, Gibson just missed the detail of the story that is understood in the proper sense of history and with critical perspective. And in fact, he makes a rather startling statement that you've already read on the screen. The crime for which Jesus was killed was sedition, not blasphemy, a civil crime, he says, not a religious one. Let me tell you the response to that, and I make no apology for giving you the literal words of the Gospels, because either they are inspired and historically accurate, or you can take your Bible and pitch it in the trash. Because the fact of the matter is, if it's not accurate, it's not God's book. If it's not God's book, then it doesn't make any difference whether you like it or not, whether you use it or not. Go get you a Koran. Or find you some sort of church discipline. It's all the same. Doesn't make any difference. It's not authoritative. But if it is God's book, and Meacham claims that he believes that, if it is God's book, then it is historically accurate. If God is an infallible God, otherwise he's some sort of bumbler who couldn't get the facts right and didn't get it right to his authors, that is the New Testament writers. If it is historically accurate, God's book, then we ought to be able to depend on it. You have to choose. That was the real point of the sermon last Sunday morning. So I make no apology to you that I will cite the specific details. And in the Gospels, and not just in one Gospel, but in each of the three here, synoptics, the text indicates that the high priest and the council condemned Jesus for blasphemy. He has spoken blasphemy. What further need do we have of witnesses? You've heard his blasphemy. What do you think? He's deserving of death, they answered. In John 19, verses 6 and 7, this is important. When the chief priests and officers saw him, they cried out saying, "Crucify him, crucify him." Pilate said to them, "You take him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him." The Jews answered him, "We have a law, and according to our law, he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God." But later on in the sermon, we're going to note that Meacham doesn't have the slightest clue what blasphemy is. But here, through the comparison of these gospel accounts, we certainly have a definition. The Jews considered it blasphemy for any created man being to claim to be God. Jesus said, "I'm the Son of God." That's blasphemy as far as they were concerned. John says it's the charge of claiming to be the Son of God. The synoptics say it's blasphemy. Those are the same thing. Do you see that? Meacham doesn't understand that. But the charge certainly was blasphemy. Well, why, and I've gotten ahead of myself, why in the world then would Meacham make that charge that the charge against Jesus was sedition? It's because it changed. When the Jews brought Jesus to Pontius Pilate, who could care less about blasphemy against God or any Jewish law or place, instead of charging Jesus with blasphemy before Pontius Pilate, instead the charge changed to sedition. He tells people not to pay their taxes. He says he's a king, implying that he's in opposition or in competition with Caesar. The charge changed. Meacham only sees the one charge. He doesn't want to talk about the Jews. The Jews charge him with blasphemy. Well, he goes on to say, and this is incredible, the idea of a nighttime trial as depicted in Gibson's movie is also problematic. The Gospels do not agree on what happened between Jesus' arrest and his appearance before Pilate, save for one detail. Here's the only thing that the Gospels agree on between Jesus' arrest and when he comes to Pilate. Jesus was brought before the high priest in some setting. That's the only point they agree on. And friends, that's just a blatant... That's either just ignoring what the Gospels have to say or a blatant lie. I see somebody mouthing the word lie. Well, I'll let you be the judge of that. But nevertheless, the Gospels are very clear about a number of things, and they agree on various things. However, the reason for Meacham saying this is that the Gospels don't each record every aspect of the trial. And so you've got some details that are produced in Luke's or presented in Luke's Gospel that are not presented in Matthew's Gospel or Mark's Gospel. John's Gospel has even still other details. In order to understand what really happened, you've got to put all that together. Meacham doesn't seem to understand, of course, that there were two high priests in the time of Jesus. Somewhat of an anomaly, certainly with respect to the law of Moses, and historically speaking also. But see, the Romans had replaced Annas, who was the real high priest, with Caiaphas, his son-in-law, and they were dealing with Caiaphas, but the Jews took Jesus to Annas first, and then to Caiaphas, and then there was a presentation of Jesus prior in front of the council. But I want to deal with this whole question of the idea of a nighttime trial as depicted in Gibson's movie is also problematic. Because friends, you don't have to search very hard to figure out that that's just basically untrue. For instance, Jesus, of course, celebrated the Passover with his disciples. In conjunction with that, he instituted the Lord's Supper. And it was at that point, as they were eating prior to the supper, that Jesus identifies Judas as the betrayer and by giving him a piece of bread. Verse 30, having received the piece of bread, he, Judas, then went out immediately and it was night. So at the point that Judas leaves the other disciples, it's night. Now look at a couple of other passages here in John 18. When Jesus has gone up into the Garden of Gethsemane, Judas like now has his hands been called. Jesus obviously knows who he is and what he's up to. So he goes and he gets his party of people designed to betray Jesus, and he meets Jesus and the other disciples in the Garden of Gethsemane. And Judas, having received a detachment of troops and officers from the chief priests and Pharisees, came there with lanterns, torches, and weapons. How many of you carry around a flashlight during the day? Why would you? You need those at night. That's why they're carrying lanterns and torches, because it's night. Now, Jesus is betrayed, arrested there, he's taken, and the Gospels record that he appeared before Annas, before Caiaphas, before the council, that is the Sanhedrin. And then notice in John 18, verse 28, then they led Jesus from Caiaphas to the Praetorium, and what time was it? It was early morning. So Jesus was arrested in the garden at night and taken to Pilate in the morning. If there was any Jewish trial, when would it be? Well, John Meacham may be managing editor of Newsweek, but he seems to have his days and evenings mixed up. The only time for the Jewish trial would have been nighttime. The Gospels are clear about that. And I've cited more than one Gospel here to get the details that suggest that. When morning came, all the chief priests and elders of the people plotted against Jesus to put him to death. When they bound him, they led him away and delivered him to Pontius Pilate, the governor. That's what John 18:28 said. Early in the morning, they took him to Pilate. The trial lasted during the night and finished in the early morning, and then they took him to Pilate in the morning. Excuse me, but that's what the Gospels say. Gibson has it right. This next quotation is kind of interesting, because Meacham denies it in the opening paragraphs of his own article. He describes how Jesus has come into the city and the crowds are proclaiming him as the Messiah, as the King of the Jews. That his popularity is broad and wide. And then he asks the question, If Jesus is a severe enough threat to merit such attention and drastic action, where are his supporters? In Gibson's telling, they are silent or scared. Some probably were, and some may not have known of the arrest, which happened in secret. But it seems unlikely that a movement which threatened the whole capital would so quickly and so completely dwindle to a few disciples, sympathetic onlookers, Mary and Mary Magdalene. Now, I'm not going to respond to this particular thing as much as some of the others, but I want you to understand that when Jesus came into the Jewish city of Jerusalem, he came in the style of the Messiah. The people recognized him as the Messiah, and he spent a week teaching them that he wasn't there to set up a physical kingdom. And he discouraged a lot of disciples who did not understand the real nature, the spiritual nature of this Messiah, this anointed one of God. Furthermore, when Jesus was arrested in the garden, betrayed by his own disciple Judas, the rest of the disciples fled. Can you imagine the disciples, later become the apostles, who would flee from Jesus at the moment of his greatest need, and yet the rest of the crowds would hang tight with him? And have we lost track of the fact that this all took place at night and in a secluded place? That was the intention of the Jewish leaders. They understood that Jesus was very popular with the people. And in fact, look at Luke chapter 22 and verse 6. Judas promises to betray Jesus, and so he sought opportunity to betray him to them in the absence of the multitude. Why? Matthew tells us in Matthew chapter 26. As these leaders of the Jews are plotting to put Jesus to death, they say, verse 5, not during the feast, lest there be an uproar among the people. They anticipated the possibility of that, and so they made arrangements to have Jesus betrayed and tried in a venue that was not widely known. Betray him off in a secluded place, off on the other side of the valley, the Kidron Valley, in the Mount of Olives, in the Garden of Gethsemane, at night, when most people wouldn't know what was going on. By the time many of the Jews would have found out that Jesus had been arrested and was in danger of being put to death, he was already in the hands of the Romans and probably being scourged. Another criticism against Gibson's story of the Passion. A moment later in Gibson's movie, Pilate is questioning Jesus and facing a silent prisoner, says, "You will not speak to me? Do you not know that I have power to release you and power to crucify you?" Jesus then replies, "He who delivered me to you has the greater sin." The "he" in this case is Caiaphas. John's point in putting this line in Jesus' mouth is almost certainly to take a jibe at the temple elite. But in the dramatic milieu of the movie, it can be taken to mean that the Jews, through Caiaphas, are more responsible for Jesus' death than the Romans are. An implication unsupported by history. Do you know why Meacham says that? Do you know why he says it's unsupported by history? Because he has two secular historians who said Jesus was crucified by the Romans. And that's the end of the story. That's the real story. Jesus was put to death by the Romans. But John, in order to try to poke at the Jewish authorities, he puts this statement in Jesus' mouth. Well, once again, Meacham doesn't believe in the historicity of the Gospels. I do. The Jews were, in fact, more responsible, as we'll point out in just a few moments, than the Romans were for the death of Jesus. Another quotation. Meacham says that clear evidence of the political nature of the execution, that Pilate and the high priest were ridding themselves of a Messiah who might disrupt society, not to offer salvation, is the sign Pilate ordered affixed to Jesus' cross. The message, Meacham writes, is not from the knowing Romans to the evil Jews. It is rather a scornful signal to the crowds that this death awaits any man, the pilgrims proclaim, the King of the Jews. Meacham believes that the high priest and all of his henchmen and the Romans, in essence, were in collusion here. That they were kind of washing each other's hands and getting rid of Jesus. The Gospels, on the other hand, present tension between the Jews and Pilate. Meacham doesn't accept that. And he says the sign that Pilate ordered is evidence that there wasn't this tension. Well, look, if you will, at what John's Gospel presents here in chapter 19, verses 19 through 22. Pilate wrote a title, put it on the cross in several languages, and it said, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Verse 21, therefore the chief priests of the Jews said to Pilate, do not write the King of the Jews, but he said, I am the King of the Jews. Pilate answered, what I have written, I have written. Meacham believes that the high priests were afraid to alienate Pilate, and so they got rid of Jesus, lest the Romans take away their place. And there may be some measure of truth to that. At least the high priests were afraid of Jesus, that they might lose their position, or that the Romans might interfere. But the idea that the high priest and that Pilate were actually, in a sense, working together is absolutely unfounded in Scripture. The Jewish elite pressured Pilate into crucifying Jesus. And Pilate, in an effort to take a jibe at the Jews, identified this crucified man as their king. Now, whatever you might think about the effect that it would have on the Jews in general, it was designed to poke at the Jewish leadership. And they got it too. That's why they asked Pilate, hey, change the sign. Don't write that he is the king. Write that he claimed to be the king. Pilate said, I'm going to leave it the way it is. What I've written, I've written. And so Meacham doesn't seem to understand that this whole death was orchestrated by the Jews. The Romans became the agents of crucifixion. Nobody denies that. But that pressure had been brought to bear by the religious elite, and we'll talk more about that in just a few moments, so I'll leave the point for the moment. In the next quotation, in the memorable, if manufactured, crowd scene in the version of the movie screened by Newsweek, Gibson included a line that has had dire consequences for the Jewish people through the ages. The prefect, procurator, is again improbably resisting the crowd, the picture of a just ruler. Frustrated, desperate, bloodthirsty, the mob says, quote, his blood be on us and on our children. Gibson ultimately cut the cry from the film, and he was right to do so. What he actually cut was the legend that would identify what was being said. The crowd, of course, keeps saying it, but unless you speak Aramaic, you're going to miss the line. He cut the legend. Again, consider the source of the dialogue, a partisan gospel writer. The gospels were composed to present Jesus in the best possible light to potential converts in the Roman Empire and to put the temple leadership in the worst possible light. And many scholars believe, he writes, that the author of Matthew, which is the only gospel to include the his blood be on us line, was writing after the destruction of the temple in 70 and inserted the words to help explain why such misery had come upon the people of Jerusalem. According to this argument, blood had already fallen on them and on their children at the time that the Gospel of Matthew was written. Well, a couple of observations here. First of all, notice he says the author of Matthew doesn't say Matthew because he doesn't believe it was Matthew in the first place. And secondly, the reason that some scholars believe that Matthew was written after 70 AD is because Matthew 24 is a roadmap of the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. If Matthew had written it prior to that time, he might actually have been quoting what Jesus said, and it would have been a prophecy and would have suggested the inspired nature of both the book and, of course, of the nature of God, of Jesus as deity. And you can't believe that, so the gospel has to be pushed after the time of the fulfillment of the prophecy. Brethren, understand something. The reason that we have so much trouble teaching our neighbors is they've been filled with this kind of build for so long that when you apply the scriptures, when you preach to them the truth, they don't believe that's inspired word of God anyway. You know what we've got to do? We've got to go back and start pressing the inspiration of the scriptures again. And we need to show people that there are two options. You either accept it as inspired or we're all lost without direction. That's the only option that we have. Well, Meacham, obviously, is seeing this with a jaundiced eye. Matthew does record that statement, make that statement, When Pilate saw that he couldn't prevail at all, but rather the tumult was rising, he took water, washed his hands before the multitude, saying, innocent of the blood of this just person, you see to it. And all the people answered and said, his blood be on us and on our children. And incidentally, that statement, far from being manufactured by Matthew, is in perfect alignment with what the Jewish elite at least, had believed all along. Let's get rid of Jesus. And I'll show you that in just a moment. One more quotation, and I appreciate your patience with this section. Meacham says, and it was not blasphemy to think of yourself as the Messiah, which more than a few Jewish figures had claimed to be without meeting Jesus' fate. And that's true. There had been others who'd claimed to be Messiahs, and they weren't all accused of blasphemy. The definition of blasphemy was a source of fierce Jewish argument, but it turned on taking God's name in vain. And nothing in the gospel trial scenes supports the idea that Jesus crossed that line. Now, Meacham has a rather narrow view of blasphemy. We've already talked about the fact that Jesus was indeed accused by the Jews of committing blasphemy. John suggests that that blasphemy consisted of claiming to be the Son of God. Luke says the same thing in chapter 22, verses 70 and 71. Then they all said, are you then the Son of God? So he said to them, you rightly say that I am. And they said, what further testimony do we need? For we've heard it ourselves from his own mouth. In the other gospel accounts include the fact that they said, he spoke in blasphemy. But Luke says, listen, to claim to be the Son of God, that's blasphemy. Meacham says Jesus never crossed that line. Do you understand that that's the crucial point of our faith? What is it that we confess when we obey the gospel? I believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. Take away that, and he's nothing more than an imposter, a liar, and a crucified criminal. That's all. So does it surprise you that that would be attacked by someone who, quite frankly, doesn't believe the Bible? Whatever protestations he might make otherwise. The charge of anti-Semitism. Are the Gospels really anti-Semitic? Or do they just tell the truth about who really killed Jesus? Now, I understand there's a certain anticlimactic nature to this next section because you already know the truth. But I want you to see that the Gospels are very clear about who was responsible for Jesus being put on the cross. Jesus himself prophesied that the Jews would be guilty of his own death. In Matthew chapter 20, Jesus predicts to his disciples that they were going to go up to Jerusalem, the Son of Man would be betrayed to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death. And, he says, and deliver him to the Gentiles to mock and to scourge and to crucify, and the third day he'll rise again. Jesus said, listen, it'll be the Gentiles that'll actually crucify me, but understand that it'll be the Jews who will turn me over. They're the ones who are going to plot against me. In the parable of the vineyard in Matthew chapter 21, Jesus tells a parable in which a vineyard is put out to some vineyard keepers, and servants are sent to gather the fruits, and they kill the servants. Finally, the owner of the vineyard says, I'll send my son. They'll respect my son. They send the son. The vineyard keepers say, look, this is the son. We can kill him, then we can take the vineyard. And they kill the son. And the rest of that text says that the Jews understood that he was talking about them. Jesus told the parable and they understood that it was a charge against them as those who would kill the Son of God. The Gospels claim that the Jews were responsible for Jesus' death. The Jewish leaders plotted to put Jesus to death. You could put many scriptures up here. I chose Mark 14, verse 1. The chief priests and the scribes sought how they might take him by trickery and put him to death. In verse 55, now the chief priests and all the council at the time of the trial sought testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. That won't stop them. They'll find false witnesses. A little bit later on, a little bit earlier on, rather, in John 11, John records that after Lazarus's resurrection, that Caiaphas, who was the high priest, said to the other Jewish leaders, you know nothing at all, nor do you consider that it's expedient for us that one man should die for the people and not that the whole nation should perish. He goes on to say, John does, that he was prophesying that Jesus would die for the nation. And not for that nation only, but also that he would gather together in one the children of God who were scattered abroad. Then from that day on, they plotted to put him to death. Did the Romans put him on the cross? Certainly. Did the Jews want him on the cross? Yes. Yes, they did. And it's very clear from the Scriptures. In fact, a little bit later on, after Jesus has been resurrected, he's walking along the road and he joins a company with a couple of disciples, and they're talking, and they ask him, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem? Have you not known the things which have happened there in these days?" And he said, "What things?" They said to him, "The things concerning Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet, mighty indeed in word before God and all the people, and how the chief priests and our rulers delivered him to be condemned to death," listen, "and crucified him." Did you understand the sentence there? They delivered him to death and crucified him. The crucifixion is charged to the rulers, not to the Romans. And I'll tell you what, we're going to see that a number of times. Because in the book of Acts, in the early sermons, the apostles presented the Jews as the ones responsible for the death of Jesus Christ. Not just the rulers, but the people also. We'll look at a few passages that'll talk about the rulers. The religious leaders here in Acts chapter 4 and verses 8 through 10. Of course, Peter's talking to the rulers of the people, the elders of Israel, and he says that they had crucified Jesus of Nazareth. Look and consider chapter 5 of Acts, verses 27 through 30. The apostles are before the council, again, the rulers of the Jews, and they claim that Jesus was raised up by God, Jesus whom you murdered by hanging on a tree. Well, where were the Romans? Well, the Romans actually drove the nails, but the apostles said that the Jewish leaders put him on the tree. They were the ones responsible for his death. Consider Stephen's sermon in Acts chapter 7 and verse 52. And once again, he's speaking to the Sanhedrin. Didn't start that way, but when he preaches his sermon, he's talking to the Jewish leaders, and he says, "Of whom you now have become the betrayers and murderers." That is, the murderers of the just one, Jesus the Christ. Well, you know, even Meacham would argue that the Jewish leaders were the ones really responsible, but that the Jews in general were not responsible for this. But I want to suggest to you that in the apostles' preaching, they brought it down below the rulers and talked about the people. Look at what Peter says, and the other apostles, on the day of Pentecost. He's preaching to whom? The Jewish leaders? He's preaching to Jewish pilgrims and people in Jerusalem, Jews, men of Israel, he calls them. He says, "You have taken by lawless hands, have crucified and put to death." He's not talking to Romans, he's talking to Jews. Verse 36, toward the conclusion of the sermon, "Therefore let all the house of Israel know assuredly that God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, both Lord and Christ." I must tell you, I am amazed that anybody would ask the question, "Who killed Jesus?" All my life I've studied the Bible. It's patently plain if you are willing to accept what the Scriptures say. In Acts chapter 3, in the very passage that was read for your consideration, Peter and John suggest to the Jews who have gathered at the healing of the lame man that they asked for a murderer to be granted and killed the Prince of Life. Now drop down to verse 17. He says, "Yet now, brethren, I know that you did it in ignorance, as did also your rulers." Who's being charged with the death of Jesus Christ? Just the rulers? No, the people also. And so the Scriptures are very clear about who it is that killed Jesus. Now something else we need to note is that Pilate was in quite a predicament. Meacham argues that it's preposterous that Pilate, who was a Roman bully, and there's some truth to that, that he could have been pushed into condemning Jesus to death. Let me tell you, nothing could be farther from the truth. Pilate was a cruel individual. He did not respect the Jews, but understand there were some other forces at work here. When Pilate became procurator in AD 26, the very first thing he did was try to move the Roman army where it had been stationed in Caesarea into Jerusalem. And the idea was basically to just shut the Jewish religion down. He hadn't learned from history. The Jews met him and stopped him, said, "No, you're not going to do this. We'll give up our lives." Shades of Antiochus Epiphanes. It's the same story, just told with Roman people instead of Seleucid rulers. The reason they objected to it is, as Pilate came into Jerusalem with his Roman legions, they had standards with images on them of Caesar. And as far as the Jews were concerned, that was blasphemy. It was idolatry, I should say. And they said, not here, not now, not ever. And Pilate moved his armies back to Caesarea. Now tell me if the Jews had any power here. He resented what they did to him. They basically called his hand and said, no, you don't rule here. Not like that. Now Pilate committed a number of atrocities, at least historically where I understand that. Even the Gospels point that out. In the Gospel of Luke, he mixed the blood of some who were worshiping with their sacrifices. Pilate was not a good ruler, but the fact of the matter was, the Jews brought Jesus to Pilate because they were not allowed to put Jesus to death. One might argue that in addition to that, they didn't want to be the ones who actually put Jesus to death. They wanted to lay it on the Romans. Apparently, they've been successful with the Roman Catholic Church. Pilate, in contradistinction to the Jews, claimed that Jesus was innocent. But the Jews cried out, crucify him, crucify him. Listen to Meacham's comment. The scene of a crowd of Jews crying out, crucify him, crucify him, before Pilate has been a staple of passion plays for centuries. But it's very difficult to imagine Caesar's man being bullied by the people he usually handled roughly. Do you know why he was bullied? Why has the gospel story been told in a way that makes the Jews look worse than the Romans? As though the Romans didn't have the power here, or Pilate didn't have the power? It's because the Jewish leaders implicitly threatened Pilate with the charge of treason. Pilate, as you can see on Luke 23, asserted Jesus' innocence. But they threatened him. John chapter 19 gives us the threat. Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out saying, if you let this man go, you're not Caesar's friend. Whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar. When Pilate therefore heard that saying, he brought Jesus out and sat down in the judgment seat in a place that's called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. Pilate realized at that point he needed to deal with these people because it started to look ugly for him. You know how Pilate lost his job? He actually was removed from the position of procurator of Judea because some Samaritans, whom he had mistreated, went to Rome and the emperor got tired of it. There had been several complaints and he took him out of his office. Tell me if that's not a real threat in John 19 verses 12 to 13. Meacham seems to have lost that history. But history suggests that Pilate was in a predicament and that he could be bullied into doing what was really wrong. I'll tell you something, and I'm going to draw this to a close. I've got some other things I want to say, and if you want the outline, you can get it later, but we've gone long enough. The charge of anti-Semitism is frivolous. You know what it is? It is in essence itself a prejudicial behavior. It's like today in our society, the worst thing that can happen to you is to be called a racist. People will bend over backwards to avoid doing anything that would have them charged as racism, because racism is the quintessential evil, and quite frankly, racism is an evil. But sometimes things that have nothing to do with racism are identified that way to get people to stop doing them, because they know that's a charge that people don't want to have to be tagged with that. And so anti-Semitism is being used the same way. Instead of people asserting the truth of the Gospels, when someone does produce a film which in many ways is very accurate as far as the relationship of the Romans, the Jews, and the part that they played in the killing of Jesus, the charge of anti-Semitism is leveled because it's hoped that it will shut that kind of stuff up. And we've got people across the pulpits of the land who are now saying, and you know what, this is a good opportunity for us to get out and preach that the Jews were not responsible for the death of Jesus. What does the Bible really teach? It teaches that Jesus died for the sins of all men. I didn't want to take time, and as it turns out, I didn't have time for the things I wanted to take time for. The Bible does teach that Jesus died for the sins of all men. And so there is certainly a sense in which we put Jesus on the cross. historically speaking, the Jews put him on the cross. But I'll be honest with you, other than defending what the truth is about the story, and that of course helps us understand some other things that happened to the Jewish nation, the fact of the matter is, who put the nails in Jesus' hands and his feet is not the point, is it? Fact of the matter is, it was God's ordained plan. That was part of the reason for the selection of the songs. And Gary did an excellent job of picking songs that present another view of all of this story that the Scriptures present in other places that we didn't have time to talk about this morning. Your sins put Jesus on the cross. My sins put Jesus on the cross. Not because we're Christians, but because we're sinners. Every sinner's misdeeds and iniquities were responsible for putting Jesus on the cross. God laid on Him the stripes that we ought to have received. It was a bloody, terrible death. I read an article this week in which the author was critical of the film because it presented so much blood and violence. And the article made the observation that in the Gospels, the writers of the Gospels just said, and they crucified Him. I want you to understand something. When Matthew wrote that Jesus was crucified, people understood what that meant. They may have seen that in their lifetimes a number of times. They understood how cruel and how terrible the suffering was and how bloody that death was. When was the last time you saw somebody crucified? My purpose this morning is not to recommend or critique Gibson's film. It'll stand on its own merits or weaknesses. You can see it if you like. I would advise you, if you have children, to understand that it is an exceptionally violent film. I believe it brings out something in the story of Jesus that probably we have, in a sense, tend to lessen our own minds. We don't think about the possible consequences of a man being scourged by the Romans and all of the things that went along with that. I think Gibson has made an attempt to try to bring that out, and it may be good for some people to see that. Children, small children, may be really traumatized by it. Just like small children may not be really good subjects for witnessing public executions. They used to do that in our country. You may have to use some judgment if you choose to go. I'll warn you, it is a gory film. But the reason the gospel writers didn't detail all of this, in my opinion, is because the people of their day knew what it was all about. But we're 20 centuries away from it. And I will tell you that it is my opinion that in some ways we've lost touch with the real tragedy of that from the standpoint of physical suffering. This is not a critical statement about any of the men who lead us in the Lord's Supper and prepare our minds for the death of Christ. They do a good job. But I'll be honest with you, there are times when I know that my mind is not imagining what probably happened. That in a sense it has been sanitized in my own mind. If you're sitting in a pew this morning and you're not a Christian, understand that the Son of God, Jesus of Nazareth, God in human flesh, died for you. As Anthony pointed out, disrespected, mocked, treated horribly by the very people He came to save. We respect Him, Christians do, in our memorial of His death at the Lord's table. If you're not a Christian, you can show your love for Him by confessing Him this morning. Responding to His invitation of grace, having believed in Him and confessed Him, repenting of your sins, turning from those things that are wrong, and then submitting to baptism, burial in water for the remission of your sins. I would encourage you to do that. Jesus gave everything for you. What will you give for Him? There's nothing but the blood that'll cleanse you. And you can't contact that blood until you're buried with Him in baptism into His death. If you need to respond to the gospel this morning, won't you come as we stand and sing?